Welcome to episode number 10 of the Barbell Lifestyle Podcast, where Christina and I interview Dr. Grant Tinsley, a leading researcher in the areas of intermittent fasting and body composition measurement. In this episode, we had a really great discussion where we got into the weeds with Grant's research on time-restricted feeding in resistance-trained men and women. We discuss how short of a feeding window is too short, and how you should decide if intermittent fasting is right for you, and so, so much more. We really want to thank Grant for his time and this wonderful conversation, and we hope that you all enjoy it just as much as we did. As always, if you like the podcast and you want to support it, all we ask is that you share this episode with a friend, family member, or coworker who would benefit from it. One share can go a really long way and supports our mission to help as many people as possible to live a healthier, sustainable lifestyle. Finally, we would love you even more than we already do if you took the time to leave us a rating and review on iTunes. Ratings and reviews are how this podcast moves up the ranks and becomes accessible to even more people. Thanks again for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this episode, number 10, our interview with Dr. Grant Tinsley on intermittent fasting and meal timing. Hello, guys, and welcome to episode number 10 of the Barbell Lifestyle Podcast. Today, we are so, so excited to bring on a very special guest, someone that I look up to in this industry and in research a lot. His name is Dr. Grant Tinsley, and he is at Texas Tech University, and he is a leading researcher in the areas of intermittent fasting, and we'll get into why that's not really the technical term for it, but time-restricted feeding and as well as body composition measurement. And we're really, really excited to have him on, and hopefully we'll have him on again. But today we're going to focus in on intermittent fasting, meal timing, and what time-restricted feeding really is. So we have Grant on right now. So let me allow him to introduce himself, kind of how he got into this area of research and just introducing us to the concept of time-restricted feeding.
Yeah, no, thanks so much for having me on. I'm really excited to be here. As I mentioned to you offline, I got to first listen to your podcast while touch-up painting my house, which is pretty exciting. So it was neat to hear about the vision for the podcast. I'm glad it's been a successful start for you all. So yeah, thanks again for having me. A little bit about myself. I, like several people probably in this area, originally got interested in some of these topics just due to my own interest in lifting. So I was in the gym lifting weights, enjoying that long before I ever studied any of this academically. I did study nutrition and physiology in my undergraduate work. Still wasn't exactly sure where I wanted to go with that. I did a master's degree in biomedical sciences, which largely focused on anatomy and physiology. I got to do a lot of cadaver dissection, really gain a greater appreciation for the human body that way. And then after that point is really when I got into human research in my PhD program, which was in kinesiology and exercise nutrition. So the PhD program is when I first formally studied exercise, even though I had, you know, trained for a number of years and gotten my strength and conditioning certification as well. So anyways, I have sort of a mix of, you know, personal interest in this and now academic interest. I've been an assistant professor at Texas Tech University for about 4.5 years now. So I direct a research lab there with about a dozen students. And we conduct a variety of studies on sports nutrition topics, several related to intermittent fasting or time-restricted eating, quite a few related to body composition assessment, some related to dietary supplements, and even physique competitors as well. So yeah, that's a little bit about me. In terms of how I got interested in this research area, when I started my PhD program, my advisor had played a large role in writing a large position stand for a sports nutrition organization. And the topic of the position stand was meal frequency. And this was sort of back at the time, I think it was 2011 when he wrote this. This was sort of at a time when the standard recommendation was that you need a very high meal frequency, sort of regardless of what your goal was. It's like, if you want to lose fat, eat a bunch of small meals all day. You want to gain muscle, eat a bunch of small meals all day. Health, anything. The answer is always like, eat every 2 to 3 hours. So some of their major conclusions were essentially that there wasn't very strong evidence for that. I'm not saying it was harmful per se, but there wasn't this strong, robust evidence that you would expect given how frequently that recommendation was made. So that's kind of where I came in, and through discussions with this advisor, we sort of got to thinking about, okay, what about the other end of the spectrum? Like, how low of a frequency would be okay? If 3, 4, 5 meals is fine, and if 10 meals a day isn't better, how low could you go before you did see a problem, say in terms of adaptations to exercise? So that was sort of the background. We wrote sort of a big review article as intermittent fasting was starting to get a little more popular in the research, and published that to kind of get some information out there. And then I conducted my first trial of time-restricted eating and resistance training while I was a PhD student there, and have sort of continued that on into my faculty role here. So that's a little bit, but if you want me to jump into anything else in the background, feel free to let me know.
No, that's great.
I think it would be good to start, sorry, Marissa, to jump into maybe, you know, if we have a listener who isn't familiar with the terms that you're using right now, maybe to go ahead and define them. So moving forward, they know the difference between the two
or yes. three. No, I'm happy to do that. And I feel like it's one of the most important conversations to have, and something people sort of gloss over, like, oh yeah, you know, I know what intermittent fasting is, we can move on. But I'll give the caveat that not everyone agrees on this. This is my opinion from sort of being in this area and reading research in this area. But you could certainly ask another researcher who might disagree with some of the things I'm about to say, but I'll give you my summary. So intermittent fasting, it is sort of the popular term, the term that's out there. To me, it is a very broad term. So within the research, it refers to a number of different subtypes of intermittent fasting. They're all united by a few basic characteristics. So those characteristics are, first, these are programs that focus on when you eat, not necessarily what you eat. So there's a lot of flexibility here in terms of what foods are eaten, what macronutrient ratios are used. And this kind of presents a contrast with many popular types of diets that are very focused on macronutrient ratios or limiting or emphasizing certain macronutrients. So first thing for intermittent fasting focuses on when you eat, not necessarily what you eat. There are also regularly occurring fasting periods that are longer than typical overnight fast. And of course, typical overnight fast will vary based on the person. Based on population level data in the US, there are a large, large number of people who essentially eat from the time they wake up in the morning till the time they go to bed. So they exhibit these very long feeding periods of, you know, sometimes 15 hours or more. Of course, though, there are other people who say they don't like to eat breakfast. They don't eat breakfast. They don't tend to snack late at night. They might consume all their calories in about an 8-hour period of time, even without intentionally using any form of, say, intermittent fasting. So those are a couple broad principles. Within that broad term intermittent fasting, there are a few subtypes. So the one I think people are most familiar with in the kind of specific subtype that usually gets sort of ascribed to the broad term intermittent fasting is time-restricted feeding, also known as time-restricted eating. And this is sort of, you know, what I was alluding to a second ago. It's really just eating all your calories within a certain period of time each day. So again, everyone, you know, there's some variability in terms of people, just what they naturally tend to do. In terms of spreading their eating out over the day. But normally time-restricted eating would be shortening relative to whatever is normal. Often that'd be consuming all calories within a 4 to 12 hour period of time, depending on how intensive a protocol you're using. So time-restricted eating is one of the three main subtypes. Another is alternate day fasting. Originally, this is sort of like what it sounds like. You would eat every other day. So you'd eat on Monday, not on Tuesday, eat on Wednesday. Yeah, so pretty intense protocol. That would result in about 36-hour fasting periods because you'd have an overnight fast, whole day without eating, another overnight fast. It was recognized pretty quickly that this was difficult, and there were some concerns about lean mass loss with those 36-hour fasts. So most of the studies since then have used what's called modified alternate day fasting, and that's where you'd eat normally one day. The next day, you'd essentially eat one small meal that would contain about 25% of your normal weight maintenance calorie needs. And then the next day you'd eat unrestricted. So every other day you're eating normally or unrestricted, and the in-between days you're eating essentially one relatively small meal. So that's alternate day fasting. The last kind of main subtype of intermittent fasting is called periodic fasting. And this is a little bit of a broad term. It kind of catches some of the programs that are left. This essentially is implementing regularly occurring overnight fasts. Fasts that are longer than an overnight fast. These are often a little bit longer, so 24 hours, sometimes 36 hours, but they're not implemented quite as frequently. So the most frequent you'd see them implemented is up to about 2 times per week. So not quite up to the frequency of alternate day fasting, which would be about 3 of those fasting periods per week. But some people also implement these on a less frequent basis. So this could also be something as simple as 1 24-hour fast every 2 weeks, or something where you have some fasting period, but it's not occurring nearly as frequently as alternate day fasting, something, a pattern you're using every day, like time-restricted eating. So to summarize, because I know I said a lot there, intermittent fasting we do as a very broad term, with some, you know, basic features that unite all the programs. And then within that, we have time-restricted eating, alternate day fasting, and periodic fasting.
That's great. And I think to backtrack just a little bit, I think it's very interesting and very valuable how, so, you know, the old thought was, let's eat every 2 hours, and that's the best way to do it. That's the best way to go about it. And then we take a look at the opposite end of the spectrum, and we say, well, okay, how few times per day can we eat and not see negative effects? And I think this is kind of something that we see a lot in many areas of nutrition research and research in this field in general, is like, we go to one extreme and people take things way too far. And then we take it to the other extreme and people take it way too far. It's just like with the, you know, clean eating versus tracking macros dichotomy, where if you're eating 100% clean, then, you know, that's the best way to see results. And then people realize that macros exist and they say, well, I can reach my goals just by eating Pop-Tarts and and protein shakes. And then we realize, okay, the answer is actually somewhere in the middle. And we'll get into like what your research has actually found and whether or not that's true. But I just think it's interesting that that's how we go about finding these answers, is we start with one end and then we go all the way to the other end. And then we kind of like inch our way into the middle, over time. So which of the, examples that you just broke down, so which of those aligns the most closely, I think you said, was the time-restricted feeding, and that is also what you're mainly researching, is that correct?
Yes, that is primarily what we've researched, and my perception of the general population is that's often what people think of with it when they hear the term intermittent fasting. So you see that commonly, someone, you know, giving a very narrow definition of intermittent fasting. They said, oh, that's eating all your calories in an 8-hour period of time every day. And that's one type of one subtype of intermittent fasting, but that's not like the strict definition of that broad term. But yes, time restricted, even the terminology in the research evolved some. So our first few papers on this, we called time restricted feeding, which was a term kind of inherited from rodent studies. Now it's kind of trending towards time restricted eating because we're humans and we have a choice whether to eat. We're not just, you know, like fed from someone. So if I use them interchangeably, that's why it's kind of evolving towards time restricted eating, even though time restricted feeding was the original term.
Yeah. So I'm going to do my best to stick with time restricted eating, but I might slip and I might say intermittent fasting. I might say time restricted feeding, but that's going to be the main thing that I think we're going to be addressing in this podcast episode, since it is kind of the trendy, most popular hot topic that people want to know, like, does it work? Like, what is it all about? Why are we looking into this and why are people doing it? And I think one other thing that you said that's very important, that we'll get into this a little bit later too, is to keep in mind that time-restricted eating, I had to think about that one, time-restricted eating is something that is independent of your macronutrient composition and your calorie intake. And so you can reach a variety of goals while doing this. And so it is marketed very in the media, intermittent fasting is this fat loss diet, is how it's typically marketed, and how it's been popularized. But it's important to keep in mind the context of, you can literally have any food and any type of macronutrient composition, any calorie total at the end of the day with this approach. It's more of a structure and an approach to eating rather than an actual diet itself.
Yeah, I agree completely. And that's a great point. And just to reiterate, not only for the macros, but like you mentioned there at the end, just in terms of, you know, are you in energy balance? Are you in a calorie surplus, calorie deficit? Really, this, like you said, is just describing the pattern of eating. So someone could eat in an 8-hour period of time each day, and they could be in a substantial calorie deficit, or they could be in a surplus, either intentionally or say this negatively affects their appetite in some way, and then they're overeating during their feeding period, they could be in a surplus. So you're absolutely right. These patterns don't inherently say whether or not someone will be in a calorie deficit or not. though we do have data indicating that, you know, certain forms of intermittent fasting do tend to cause people to spontaneously consume fewer calories. But especially at the individual level, that, you know, may or may not be true.
Yeah, I think it's really important that we're exploring that, you know, we're always so interested in calories in versus calories out, or, you know, what types of foods are going to do what to your body composition. But we've kind of hashed that out, you know, and beaten that dead horse a few times now. But now we're looking at, okay, well, what about when I eat, and how does that actually affect what's going on with the food that I'm choosing to eat? And does that make a meaningful difference? So why don't you walk us through exactly what you've been looking at lately, or what you've looked at with your research in this area, and what those results have looked like for you in your lab?
Okay. Yeah, no, I'd be happy to. And I'll stick to the big picture for now, because we've done 4 separate studies on this, and I don't want to bore everyone to tears or to sleep with all the nitty gritty. But if you want to dive into any of the other studies in more detail that I mentioned, I'm happy to. From the big picture perspective, to my knowledge, our team has conducted the only 4 trials of time-restricted eating in combination with resistance training. So our interest is in resistance training, not that we don't love cardio. Well, actually, yeah, it is pretty much that we don't love cardio, but you know, we like the weightlifting stuff. So we've done 4 trials. The most recent one we conducted here at Texas Tech was in resistance-trained females. The other 3 have been in males of varying training levels. So 2 have been in essentially recreationally active males who were not highly trained. And then 1 was in the other end of the spectrum, mostly like natural bodybuilders. So collectively between the studies, we've looked at sort of the full spectrum of training statuses. But in each of these studies, we've implemented a progressive resistance training program. 3 of these 4 studies have used sort of the most common form of time-restricted eating, even I would say probably the most common form of intermittent fasting in general, which is having about an 8-hour feeding period each day, with that occurring from about noon to about 8 p.m. each day. One of the studies used a little bit more of an aggressive protocol, where on non-training days, all calories were consumed in 4 hours, but then on training days, unrestricted food intake was allowed. So participants were allowed to eat throughout the day just to promote good pre-exercise and post-exercise nutrition. I'm trying to think whether to go one by one or sum it up. I'll sum it up. So first, on the performance side, we haven't seen any performance decrements or impairments with intermittent fasting. In all the studies, we've seen similar improvements in muscular performance, which has largely been maximal strength, muscular endurance through tests like repetitions to failure with a certain percentage of the max strength. And then some more kind of nuanced variables like force production, rate of force development on a mechanical squat machine, kind of a whole variety of muscular performance metrics, but largely things that you could assess, you know, in the gym. So similar improvements with both programs. In general, we have seen similar lean mass gains. So all the studies that matched protein intake, so where both groups the control group essentially in all these studies would be a group that either eats unrestricted just according to their normal preferences, or that is required to eat breakfast and then just eats normally throughout the day, just to make sure there is a difference in the number of hours of eating per day between the time-restricted eating group and the control group. So in general, whenever protein intake has been similar between the control groups and the time-restricted eating groups, we've seen similar increases in fat-free mass or lean mass, as well as muscle thickness measurements. So when we use ultrasound to actually look at the thickness of certain muscle groups, say in the upper arm, in the thigh, et cetera. There have been a couple of the studies that have shown a fat loss benefit to time-restricted eating. However, all 4 of these studies were relatively free living. So even though we would like to, you know, if it weren't an ethical violation, we would like to keep all our participants in cages and just like poke the food into them. So like, okay, this is what you're eating. So we know they're eating the exact same amount. We really can't do that. So outside of a metabolic ward, which would be sort of like an inpatient study where people more or less check into a medical facility and they stay there for the whole duration of the study. Outside of that, it's really difficult to truly know if 2 groups of participants are eating the same number of calories. So even when we give out food scales, we teach people how to weigh things, we do all these records, There's still so much error involved in self-reported intake that we can't rule out the fact that even if it doesn't show up on diet records, it's possible that participants in time-restricted eating groups are just spontaneously eating less. So the couple studies that have shown a fat loss benefit, the most likely explanation is still that they ate fewer calories, whether or not the diet records clearly showed that based on, you know, the days we assessed that. Those are the big picture items. In terms of metabolism and other health markers, there have been a couple studies that have shown improvements in inflammation or blood lipids with time-restricted eating. Those were also some of the studies that show the fat loss benefit. So it's not fully clear if that was simply due to the fat loss or if that's an inherent benefit of the time-restricted eating. And then there were several studies where there was no difference. In general, for example, resting metabolic rate has not differed between the time-restricted eating and control groups. So that's sort of the brief rundown, but if you would like me to dive into any of that in more detail, I'm more than happy to.
Yeah, I do have one thing. So I listen to a ton of this type of content, of listening to researchers talk about everything that goes on in the lab. And I don't necessarily hold my clients to that standard because I think most people would probably find it boring. But one of the things that was brought to my attention by, I believe it was one of the Iron Culture podcasts, was how training in the lab can actually be some of the most intense training that you could really ever experience, because you're being basically personal trained by whoever is conducting the study, if it is supervised training, and you can touch on if this is kind of how it was in your lab or not. But even when we're looking at resistance trained individuals, and I think Christina and I see this a lot in our clients, especially females. Our females and our clients in general don't really push themselves very well. And so when you put them in a supervised environment where they are now forced to train to reps to failure over time or whatever the test might be, we often see these really big improvements in strength and performance outcomes independent of whatever the study was actually trying to measure. So I wanted to introduce that as a limitation and ask you if that's something that you think could be a factor in your research as well, looking at how performance did increase over time in both groups, or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I would say that definitely does occur. That so say I'll take our most recent study, for example. This was the one conducted here at Texas Tech in resistance trained females. We had several just badass trainers. They were resistance trained females who were just intense, who like knew how to lift, who pushed themselves, who knew what it looked like to reach failure, who were just very like the exact type of people you want training. They knew what they were doing. They walked the walk, all of that. So they were great at identifying when participants weren't actually reaching muscular failure or just shy of muscular failure. You know, if someone's just kind of looking around and dinking around and, you know, hardly breathing hard, anything, and just kind of sits down the weight and be like, oh yeah, that was to failure. They would call them on and be like, no, that wasn't to failure. We're going up in weight for the next set, all that. So that is definitely true. And that's the huge advantage to supervised training, because you know that all participants across groups are getting the same intervention. So for example, for our trainers, we had the participants not discussing whether they were in a fasting group, a non-fasting group. We told our trainers not to discuss that with them. Their job was when the participants came in, they trained them the same way without, as they would, you know, any other participant without any knowledge of what group they're in. So that's a big advantage of the supervised training, is especially with blinding, like I just described, is that you know that everyone is getting the same coaching, that is getting the same kind of relative intensity of workout. Whereas if we just hand out our workout plans and send them across the campus to the rec center, we don't really know what's going on there. So I'd say it's definitely an advantage on the research context. It does limit the generalizability a little bit. So if you were looking at the results of one of the studies, even with the full resistance training program, you're like, oh, here's the resistance training program they used. They saw really good results. I'm going to use the same program for a client, and you send it to a client. It's a little hard, and I don't know how you all monitor, but say you were just sending it to a client and they were sort of reporting back, but you weren't really seeing the workout. There would be a little bit of a limit in generalizability if you weren't sure how that client pushed. Now, maybe it's a client that pushes all the way, does it exactly like they would have, you know, with one of our trainers looking over their shoulder. But it's also within the realm of possibility that some particular clients may not really push with the same intensity. One other thing on that note, just because you mentioned you like this stuff, something I saw that I think really helped our participants collectively push themselves was just the camaraderie. So having several participants in there at once, and people would kind of sync up with the same schedules of when they would come into the gym. We'd essentially have it open all Monday, Wednesday, Friday afternoon, and they'd check in. So there was kind of like the noon to 2 p.m. crowd, the later crowd, you know, they would come together and they'd push themselves. They'd see like, oh, she's doing more weight than she was last week. Like, I'm going to push myself, all that. So just kind of a very positive, productive environment in terms of, I think, getting the best effort out of everyone. So that's not about the fasting per se, but just some of the things you observe when you do a supervised training study.
Yeah, I think you can look at that from both perspectives too, because, you know, you can introduce it as a limitation and you can say, well, they're all going to see gains because of this environment. But also now you're completely standardizing the training protocol, like you said. And so whether someone is fasting or not isn't considered by the trainer. All that the trainer knows is that you're going to be pushing someone until they want to puke, or, you know, close to that, right? And so it kind of gets rid of, like, let's say you did hand out the training programs and that was it. The people maybe in the time-restricted eating group, maybe they put nocebo'd themselves into thinking, oh, I'm tired because I'm restricting my food intake, you know, before I go train or whatever. My feeding window's different, so my training might suffer. If that's something that's already planted in their head, then that can kind of affect their training. Whereas with this supervised training, now you're getting rid of that. So I think you could look at it as a limitation, but you could also look at it as a positive aspect. So I think maybe it might just be a neutral type of thing.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's always a double-edged sword. Like whenever you control something in the lab, it kind of limits how easily you can generalize it. But if you control nothing, then it can affect the validity of your conclusion. So no, I agree completely.
I think it's really cool though, to see a lot of research trending to the more physique focused people and people who do strength train. I think that's really cool. And then especially to now focus on females who strength train, because there is not a lot of literature in that. But I think I was listening, I can't remember what podcast I was listening to, but they were talking about that it's not so much that they're trying to discriminate between, you know, females, but rather that females have a lot of other things that are going on, like hormonally, that can affect some of the data and the outcomes. So is there anything that you've seen along those lines with your research?
Yeah, no, I love that you asked that, because, and that is a real concern. I feel like I've often hear that as sometimes a legitimate answer and sometimes a little bit of a cop out of like, oh, you know, we studied this in males because of hormones, something like that. So I personally, the first study I had done in my doc program was in resistance trained males, probably for some similar reasons, but in just accessibility, we had access to a greater population of resistance trained males. But we try to do this in as many of our studies as we can, but with intermittent fasting, I specifically wanted to do a study only in females, just because I didn't view that as a very legitimate reason. And even if there were some limitations, so like in our study, we reported to the extent we could menstrual cycle data. For context, because we had resistance trained females, there were approximately a quarter to a third who did not have regularly occurring cycles. So there was no way to really try to schedule assessments based on the menstrual cycle or anything like that. And then we had, you know, wide variety of cycle lengths and those that did have regularly occurring or semi-regularly occurring menstrual cycles. So we sort of reported that to the best of our ability, like what phase each participant was in at their assessments, and just kind of the percentage overall of participants in a particular menstrual phase. So there will always be like some, I think, questions there, maybe particularly related to some of the blood markers, not knowing for sure how affected those would be. But to me, I didn't want that to prevent us from conducting the study in females, particularly because of some of the things you hear, which I think aren't fully resolved about fasting in females, saying like, oh, you know, intermittent fasting might be okay for males, but it isn't okay for females because of X, Y, and Z, which could be true, could not be true. But if no one did the studies in females, we would never get, you know, any closer to seeing that. So, right. Sorry, that was kind of a long twisted answer to what you asked, but big picture, yeah, you do often see that. And that's something kind of personal in our lab. When possible, we like doing studies in both males and females to see if there are sex differences. But for this one, we really just felt strongly about doing a study in females exclusively.
Mm-hmm. I love that you're not letting that be a limitation, because Christina, you just dove right into what I'm actually researching for my master's thesis. So with my limited knowledge, Grant, I can kind of reassure you that from the literature review that I was able to write this past fall, I was looking at the difference between naturally menstruating women or women on hormonal birth controls and its effects on either nutritional intervention, outcomes, performance, or strength training outcomes. Essentially, on a group level, not many of the studies were able to find a significant difference. And even if there was, it was a very weak one. And there's just a lot of limitations because there are so many things that you have to control for when you're looking at that kind of thing in females. So I love that you're not allowing that to just be a blanket limitation, because it would be very easy to say that. But ultimately, at everything that has been looked at so far, women who are naturally menstruating versus on a hormonal contraceptive, those seem to be very viable to be a control group in any sort of study, or in an intervention group in any sort of study. And what we've seen so far with strength training, endurance training, and nutritional interventions is differences on a group level that are so small that if you're trying to look at something as big as changing a 16-hour feeding window to a 4-hour feeding window, I can't see any reason why that would be such a large limitation. So this is obviously something I'm very early looking into, but I'm super passionate about, and I'm really glad you brought this up, because I think someone who's listening to this who might think like, oh yeah, you can't research women because, you know, it's all going to be different because of their hormones. So far, it doesn't really seem like there's a lot of conclusive stuff towards that.
Yeah, no, that's great. And that's good to have that confirmation. And I know there are a few good meta-analyses too, which if you like this area, you've probably seen from like Kirstie Elliott Sale, yes, that have come out in the last year that, I think are shedding light on a critical area, particularly in some of these exercise related studies where, female participants are traditionally underrepresented.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And I love both of those meta-analyses, the one on menstrual cycles and the hormonal contraceptives. So before we get into a totally different niche, we'll link those in the show notes for sure. But I wanted to ask you, Grant, so you're looking at different windows for time-restricted eating. And I guess the next question I have for you to pull us back onto the track here is how short do you think that we can make this feeding window before we do start to see those negative outcomes? So how far into that extreme can we go before maybe we do start to see performance or decrements? Because from what it looks like with your research right now, there weren't too many big differences, but I guess this is more speculation.
Yeah, so I'd say from the research we've done, I'm comfortable saying that in resistance-trained individuals, and these weren't, some of them were very, very trained. I'd say they weren't elite, as in someone whose vocation, their livelihood is their physical performance. Or we have had some physique competitors in there, including the one in males I mentioned that had a number of natural bodybuilders over in Italy. But I'd say, so for well-trained individuals, but individuals who aren't making their vocation on this, I would say that down to 7.5 hours seems fine. The context there is that their eating frequency was like 3.5 to 4 feedings within that period of time. And the overall protein intake was relatively high, like within recommended levels for active individuals. So it was about, on average, 1.6 grams per kilogram per day. So with that context, then I'd say down to 7.5 hours is probably fine. It's a little interesting. The one study where we had those shorter feeding periods of 4 hours, they didn't lose lean mass, but there may have been a little bit of a compromise in the gain in lean mass. However, that was the first study that we conducted when I was a PhD student, and we left it completely open. We didn't provide protein supplements like we did in future studies. It was very just free living. These are the only parameters, eat during these times. We'll see what happens. And that group that was limited on those 4 days per week on their non-training days, overall, they self-selected because of that restriction, a lower protein intake. So we can't say necessarily that 4-hour window caused that, but it's possible. If I had to guess, I would probably say about 6-hour eating window is as low as I'd recommend. And that would be if you could still get sufficient protein and spread out to at least 3 feedings. So say right at the beginning of the feeding window, middle of the feeding window, and end of the feeding window. And those might be some relatively large meals, depending on, you know, what calorie target you're going for, in some pretty high protein meals. If you're trying to get up to 1.6 grams per kilogram in three meals, that's a lot of protein in each meal, or maybe protein shakes between meals or something like that. So a little bit speculative. I think once you're down to the really extreme programs, like one meal a day, which would essentially be 1 hour of eating, or, you know, two, three, probably even 4 hours, I'm guessing those would be too low for optimal adaptation. So if I had to guess, I'm guessing around 6 hours would be as low as you could go. And with 6 hours, you would need to have everything kind of timed up really well and pay a little more attention to making sure you get all the nutrients you need in that window.
Yeah, I think that that makes a lot of practical sense too, because ultimately in our society, and I guess we could definitely jump into to why this might be impractical for some to make it too low, is because we live in a society where we eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner typically, or at least lunch and dinner for most people. And so it makes sense that, you know, if you're going to try to have your feeding window be 6 hours, and then, you know, train within that window so that you can have proper pre and post workout nutrition, you know, it's really like cutting things really short and putting a lot of, I think for some people, I know for myself, if I tried to do that, I would probably feel more stressed trying to stick to something like that than if I were to just eat, you know, across the day or have a longer eating window. So I think when you are thinking about restricting your eating window for whatever reason, making sure that it's something that is worth the trade-off to you. And I think there's a lot of different contexts where you could kind of weigh out the pros and cons, but that's just one of them, where it might be more stressful to adhere to something that extreme versus something that might be more sustainable for you, which is mainly the theme of our podcast here, is sustainability.
I agree.
Yeah, I guess with that being said, kind of jumping into the practical applications of time-restricted eating and time-restricted feeding, and you touched on this a little bit already, but you know, we tend to see a decrease in total calorie intake when we are shortening the feeding window for most people. You know, it to a moderate extent, you know, maybe 8-12 hours or 8 or 10 hours. And could you maybe touch on, you know, how this happens? Why do you think that's the trend that we see, and why that has created this popularized intermittent fasting? Is this magic thing that makes you eat less calories and helps you lose weight?
Yeah, I'll, yes, I'm happy to answer that. I'll touch on a few things. One kind of related to that last point, sort of circling back to what we talked about when we were defining intermittent fasting, I think some of the reason, well, from the big picture, I think some of the reason, you know, certain diets get popular is someone goes on this diet or this nutritional program, they experience a lot of success, they become an advocate for it. We have some vocal advocates for, you know, every type of diet we see. I think there are a large number of relatively vocal advocates for intermittent fasting because it can agree with so many different people's food preferences. So again, because we're not addressing what you eat, and say eating 8 hours a day is for most people not that difficult. So say someone was eating from the moment they woke up till the moment they went to bed. And let's even pair that with some other behaviors, like say the things they were eating late at night before bed were not the most nutrient dense. These were hyper palatable foods while they're watching TV, something like that. So not everyone would fall in this category, but there'd be lots of people in, say, our country that would fall into this camp. So they limit to an 8 hour feeding window. That might be, maybe they're not eating breakfast as early, but maybe more importantly, essentially after dinner and or kind of an early evening snack, they're not doing that late night eating. But they're still eating the foods they prefer for their lunch, for their dinner, for their snacks in between. They've done something that maybe isn't too difficult once they get used to it, that may produce really good effects. If they're cutting out 500 calories of junk food, so to speak, or hyper palatable food that they don't need at that point late in the day, they may see really good success and be like, oh, this is great. I'm still eating the foods I like. I don't have to track. All I do is like eat between this time and this time. Then one of those people can become sort of vocal advocate. So I think because it can agree with so many different styles, you could do high carb, low carb, high protein, high fat. You could do sort of anything that would fit with this plant-based carnivore, I guess, anything in that period. I think that's part of the popularity, is just because lots of people would agree like, oh yeah, intermittent fasting, yeah, that's fine. Limit your calories this period of time. And you don't really get into some of the more contentious waters of what you eat or macronutrient ratios and all that. So that's kind of one point. And let me think if I can remember the first question you actually asked. Can you remind me, sorry, the first part of your question?
I think that pretty much covers it.
Okay, perfect.
Just how that intermittent fasting or time-restricted eating really works. But I think that we have now had some studies in the research on not just time-restricted eating in general, but specific window. So we've seen early time-restricted eating and late time-restricted eating or later. Would you mind elaborating on which windows your studies were specifically looking at, and then maybe any differences between what the early time-restricted eating has found versus later? Because I know that a lot of people have heuristics around not eating carbs after it gets dark outside or after a certain time in the evening, based on, you know, your blood glucose being a little bit higher in the evening versus the morning, or your insulin sensitivity being a little bit better in the morning versus the evening. So how does that play into these feeding windows? And do we see a difference between the early and the late?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the terminology here is important, which you are using the correct terms there, but it's kind of interesting because late time restricted feeding is normally, it's what we've used in our studies. It's what most people be familiar with. That'd be something like eating from noon to 8 p.m. So while there's not an exact definition, late would more or less be when you're finishing your eating period at a relatively normal time to finish eating for the day. So like 8 p.m., reasonable time to finish eating. Mm-hmm. Early time-restricted eating is when you completely shift that up. So you're eating from, say, breakfast at a normal time, and you're essentially eating your dinner or your last meal of the day in the mid-afternoon. So it is early, but the interesting thing about late is, in the example I just described, say cutting off eating at 8 p.m., for a lot of people who tend to snack later into the evening, that's actually shifting their calorie intake earlier in the day, even though we're calling this late time-restricted feeding. It's still time-restricted, and I haven't really seen any many forms of time-restricted feeding, with the absence of a few forms of religious fasting, haven't really seen forms that encourage or allow you to eat late into the night. So I'll talk about the early and late, but just with the caveat that even late time-restricted feeding of, say, ending eating around 8 p.m., even 8:30 p.m., for many individuals, that does actually limit or remove some of that late-night eating, which we do know there are some potential metabolic disadvantages to eating at night in terms of things you mentioned, how your body essentially processes his meal, particularly in reference to carbohydrate. So the idea with early time-restricted feeding is that if you shift more of your calories earlier in the day, that you, when you eat, you will be aligning your feeding better with your natural circadian rhythms. So the natural rhythms in your body that sort of ebb and flow at predictable times throughout the day, and that relate to things like how you process nutrients, your energy expenditure, your hunger, and so on. So there's a good strong rationale for this, for eating breakfast because you have better insulin sensitivity in the morning, for just shifting more of your calories early in the day. There are even some interesting weight loss studies where they have had multiple groups consume the same number of calories each day, with some essentially having a large breakfast, medium-sized lunch, and small dinner, and another group having the opposite pattern where they eat larger and larger meals throughout the day. In the groups that eat the larger breakfasts, in several of those studies have demonstrated greater weight loss, even when the diets are supposed to be isocaloric, so matched for calories. So there's a good rationale for moving the calorie intake earlier in the day. The few studies that have been conducted on this so far give some good preliminary results, but I would say are far from definitive. And I would say overall haven't shown as overwhelming of benefits for the early time-restricted eating as you would hope for. Not to say there aren't any, and not to say we don't need to do a lot more research here, because we do, but I'd say it's too early to say, oh, everyone has to be doing early time restricted feeding, this will solve all your problems, so to speak. The disadvantage of early time restricted feeding would be really some of these practical factors. So if you think about eating dinner mid-afternoon, how agreeable would that be for most people's lifestyle? Probably not very. If you're talking about eating dinner with friends, family, social occasions, all kinds of things, those are cut out. If you think about busyness, so say people in sort of a traditional work setting where they're at the office or they're running around doing all this stuff during the day, the evening is usually when they have time to slow down, relax, maybe when they have greater access to food. Again, those social opportunities, to me, I think that would be a difficult time not to eat. Some of the data show that you can get over that in terms of actual hunger, that hunger can be managed with early time-restricted feeding where they're not just overwhelmingly hungry in the evening. But from the big picture perspective, I don't think it would have great adoption by the general population just because of some of those factors.
So something that Marissa and I have talked about with our clients is we have some people who are eating quite a bit of food. And so something like intermittent fasting wouldn't be something that would work for them because they struggle already with getting enough calories in. So we've talked about that as being maybe a tool that you can utilize when you are trying to lose weight. So for example, when I prep, towards the end of my prep, I get down to pretty low calories. So intermittent fasting is something, or time restricted feeding is something that works for me, or eating is something that works for me, because it's, you know, towards the end of the day is when I'm like, well, I'm really hungry, or, you know, am I going to be able to make it, you know? So if I can push off eating for a little bit in the morning and then have a shorter eating period in the afternoon, evening, that seems to work better for me. But in the off season, when I'm eating a lot, that's something I can't implement because I'm just going to be trying to push too much food within too short of a period of time.
Yeah. And I can echo that. I have a lot of clients who, you know, we start increasing their food because, you know, most of the time nowadays we get clients and these women are just not eating enough. And so the first thing we do is we start up their metabolism. We get them eating more, but they're already in this habitual, kind of unintentional late feeding window of they don't start eating until maybe their lunch break at work. Maybe they are so busy running around. And so they get, you know, they go from eating 1200 calories a day to eating 1800, 1900, 2000 per day with their new training protocol. And they're telling me, hey, Marissa, I feel bloated. I feel gross. You know, something's not working here. And so what's important here is we can take some aspects of what we've learned with this time-restricted feeding of, okay, well, maybe because we've increased your calories, like Christina said, that pushing everything later in the day isn't going to work. You know, maybe we need to implement having a meal earlier in the day so that you can have a normal sized dinner and not have 1,000 calories left to eat after that and just feeling disgusting, because no one wants to do that, or, you know, most people don't want to do that. And so I think it's important to analyze the practicality of all of these methods and kind of draw that line between the research and real life, because we can always take what we're learning in the research into, you know, practical application, but that doesn't mean that what we're doing in the studies is exactly what we need to do with our clients. So like, for example, with that early time restricted eating, yeah, maybe there are some slight inherent benefits to shifting all of your food earlier in the day. But what happens when that person who says, well, I'm going to do time-restricted eating earlier in the day because it's optimal, but then every single time they're invited out to dinner with friends, they go way overboard and put themselves into a 5,000 calorie surplus. And then they're you know, in gaining weight every week instead of losing. So we have to look at not just, okay, this is how the physiology works. If we control for everything, this is how this is beneficial. But also looking at, okay, well, what can we adhere to? And what's going to make us feel good? And those are some of the two biggest things with coaching that, you know, you can't really study in a lab because it's so individual.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a great point. This is true of most of the nutrition research in general. It's very focused on weight loss, fat loss. If you're talking about gaining body mass, gaining lean mass, you could kind of apply some of the principles in reverse. So just like, you know, you talked about, it's like, if you have a client who's eating in an 8-hour window, naturally, just for practical factors, because of lunch breaks, this and that, and you're trying to increase the calories, but they will feel bloated, uncomfortable, whatever it would be, adding more calories in that period. A simple way to do it is like, okay, we're adding a 400 calorie breakfast, and prioritizing that, and they'll increase your total daily calories without pushing more into that window. So no, I think you're right. You can just sort of reverse some of those principles and sort of do the exact opposite for a different goal. And I think that's great. I've had some people ask me, it's like, okay, I'm really wanting to bulk. I want to gain a lot of weight. Like, would intermittent fasting be good? And I usually think like, why would you do that? You're making your life so much harder. It's like, okay, I'm not going to eat, which might be hard for some people. And then I'm just going to eat an absurd amount, which would be hard. So no, I agree. There are contexts where I don't think it would make any sense to consider. And then Christy, like you mentioned, others where it's like, okay, this might help me. I'd rather eat two kind of substantial, you know, relative to a low calorie intake, two kind of substantial meals and a snack or two within a shorter period of time. So I feel satisfied for some portion of the day rather than having my couple hundred calorie snacks every, you know, few hours throughout a whole day.
Yeah. And I think there's a big piece of that psychology of being able to eat those larger meals. So let's say you are, you know, trying to use intermittent fasting or time restricted eating to, you know, help you to feel more satiated every time that you do sit down to eat. And I've heard this anecdotally from a lot of people that, you know, it helps many adhere to a calorie deficit because they're able to sit down, have a bigger meal. And then there's also times of the day where they just know that they're not going to be thinking about food. And so, you know, they might physiologically be hungry during that time, but because it's kind of just blocked off as like, this is not when I eat, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind in a way.
Yeah.
I feel like there's been a lot of research outside of weight loss and more just for overall health, where people will do, you know, 24, 48 hours, even as far as 72 hour fast, just for, they feel like it's like a natural detox for the body or it's restarting. What are your experiences or what have you seen with research in that regard?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question because there are definitely physiological changes that occur during those longer fasts of say longer than 24 hours, but especially maybe getting into a day or two. There are physiological changes that occur then that don't occur in this short, like 16 hour fast that most people are accustomed to. As a quick side tangent, I think this is a little bit of an issue with interpretation. People will sometimes find some study and showing like fasting dramatically changed this health marker. And they're like, oh, fasting changed this health marker. I'm going to do, you know, a 16 hour fast every day and I'll have this health benefit. But if you look at the study where they found that, the participants were doing a 72 hour fast or 48 hour fast, and it's really not the same thing. Some of this relates to things like ketone body production, a whole host of changes that occur essentially as your liver glycogen is depleted. Many different things come into play with those longer fasts. So my opinion on those longer fasts would be there's a reasonable rationale for thinking there'd be some health benefits to those fasts. There's really strong animal data indicating that, not as strong of human data yet. I think some of the benefits that get ascribed to those fasts related to detox or giving the digestive system a break or some of those things might be framed a little bit questionably or might be overstating things a little bit. But I don't think it's wrong to say that there's a reasonable rationale there could be a benefit there. Now, I certainly wouldn't say, I wouldn't ever advocate, be like, oh, you're coaching people, tell everyone to do a 72-hour fast every month or something like that. Mm-hmm. But if someone wants to, they feel like it provides them some benefit, I definitely, and they feel like they can do it safely, I wouldn't discourage that because I don't think it's unreasonable to think there could be some benefits there. You certainly wouldn't want to do those too frequently. And normally, like you were describing, it'd be, you know, more of an occasional thing.
I've seen some like anecdotal, I guess, from some people saying that they kind of, it helps them not think about food. That they shift their focus elsewhere and they feel, I would think it'd be the opposite, but they feel more mental clarity, because they're not having to think about food and, you know, I'm so hungry that eventually they get to the point where they push past that hunger. And they feel like after the 48 hour, 72 hour, they feel like they don't have those cravings for maybe those hyper palatable foods anymore. So I think it's very interesting, but it, kind of like you said, that it gets to a point where it might not be beneficial the longer you go.
Yeah. No, that's really interesting. And there is a little bit of research showing, which is kind of an unexpected finding when this started coming out, but that some of the fasting programs can stabilize appetite. So you have less dramatic swings in appetite throughout the day with some of these fasting programs, which could be related to some of the items you're mentioning, you know, less craving of certain types of foods with some of these fasting programs. So yeah, definitely an interesting area. And I'd say within the realm of, you know, if it works for this individual, great for them. And if it doesn't for someone else, they don't have to, you know, necessarily put themselves through that.
Right. It's just whatever works for that individual and what they prefer.
Yeah. Yeah. That's how I view it for this.
What a great segue. I was just about to say, I wanted to dive into, okay, so maybe you have a coach or maybe you are a coach or maybe you're just looking to formulate the best dieting approach or just weight maintenance, weight gain, whatever your goals are, especially because we're recording this in early January. So a lot of people are setting big goals for the new year. How do we apply this and how do you take all of this information that Grant has given us to apply it to you and what's going to be right for you? Because like we've touched on multiple times, there's not going to be any one size fits all when it comes to changing your feeding window, or even if you're going to do that at all. And so I kind of wanted to just touch on, okay, well, how do we make this decision? And I think some of the important things to look at, and you guys can definitely add on to this list, is to look at the context of your life. So that's going to be probably the first one. A lot of people, we live this 9-to-5 lifestyle. So, you know, is shifting all of your food up until, you know, 2 p.m. going to be the best thing for you? Maybe not, if you're going to be going out and having social events with people in the evenings, or you typically tend to have dinner with your family after work hours. So taking a look at the context of your life, you know, what hours you work, do you work a 9-to-5? Do you work shift work? Are you a student? Is your schedule totally random or variable? That's going to play a really, really big role in how you're going to be able to actually structure your meals. And that's not just with time-restricted eating, but that's with any kind of structure and routine in general. And then, you know, the type of person that you are and the size meals that you enjoy. Do you like to sit down every couple of hours and eat, or do you prefer larger meals? And this can also change depending on the context of what your goals are. So maybe in a fat loss phase, you really crave those big decadent meals. But when you're in a gaining phase, like we talked about, you more so just want to get the calories in, right? And so maybe you're snacking all day long to be able to achieve that without having to, you know, sit down and feel sick after every meal. And then finally, I think one thing that we haven't really touched on is your training. So timing of your training, do you train in the morning? Do you train in the evening? How does that fit into your eating schedule? And I would love to get your thoughts on this, because you have done all of your research in resistance trained individuals. How would you suggest someone look at that?
Yeah. So for that, I'd say to start out, the four studies we've done, for all four studies, we've had participants train in the fed state. So we've required them to eat something before they train. That's really just adhering to basic best practices for sports nutrition. So having some pre-exercise calories and carbohydrate, having protein intake somewhere in the couple hours before or couple hours after the training period. So that's what we've stuck to so far. I know of one study that's currently being conducted that's comparing training in the fasted versus fed state in the context of a time-restricted eating program. I'm fairly certain it got delayed because of COVID. I hope it didn't get completely scratched. I'll have to reach out about that. For now, though, until we have data to indicate otherwise, I would recommend training in the fed state, unless you're dealing with someone who normally trains fasted and that's just what they prefer. If it's someone that trains first thing in the morning and they can't stomach food before that, so they train, then they eat, that's completely fine. In terms of implementing an intermittent fasting program, I'd say the biggest challenge would probably be someone that wants to do a fairly traditional time-restricted eating of, say, eating noon to 8 p.m., but they train first thing in the morning. Generally, sports nutrition guidelines would say you don't train fasted and stay fasted. It'd be, if you do train fasted, then be sure you get protein and other nutrients in the sort of post-exercise period. So that would be the most challenging application. If I were advising someone in that situation, I might recommend more selectively applying time-restricted eating to either rest days or, say, like low-intensity days. If there was some relatively low or moderate intensity cardio, something like that might be a little bit better to if they preferred to do it fasted and stay fasted for a few more hours till their feeding window began. That might be more acceptable. I wouldn't, for optimal performance, unless, you know, someone's a little bit of an anomaly and can get optimal lifting performance fasted and prefers to stay fasted, unless someone really wants to do that, I wouldn't really recommend it. The easiest application would be for someone who trains in the late afternoon or early evening and wants to do a traditional feeding window. So say they're eating from noon to 8 p.m. and they are available to train at 4 or 5 or 6 p.m. That's great. They've had several hours of feeding before. They can train fed. They have several hours afterwards to get some additional nutrients to promote some recovery. So I do think it depends on the context, and there may be some schedules. If you have someone who works out 6 days a week, first thing in the morning, that may be someone who, due to their schedule, wouldn't be advised to implement one of these programs. So those are just a few thoughts.
Yeah. I have a client who does something similar. She wakes up around like 3 a.m. to train. Cool. And so, yeah, she's dedicated. Oh my gosh. So she's kind of atypical in the way that she does her meal timing, is that she'll have her pre-workout meal before bedtime.
Okay.
So she'll wake up in the morning, and so she's training fasted, but she's kind of had a much bigger, higher carb meal at the end of the night, and then she'll have her typical post-workout meal. So I think it's very interesting the way that she's found something that works for her, but having that pre-workout meal like hours before she actually does train.
Yeah, no, that's great. And that's really, yeah, it's a prudent recommendation. If you gave that recommendation, if not, that's a really good idea.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting too, because, you know, as we discussed, you know, higher blood sugar, blood glucose later in the day, that tends to scare a lot of people. And that's kind of where those myths of like, oh, I'm going to gain fat if I eat carbs before bed comes from. But then, you know, again, we say, hey, look at it in this context. Does it really matter for this person if that's their A, their regular routine, and B, they're going and using those carbs at 3 a.m? So yeah, maybe their blood sugar is a little bit elevated, but like context here, you're using that in your exercise a few hours later. So I think it's very important to, and I always kind of come back to like, hey, let's hammer out the context. Let's make sure we're not just like overlooking things or overgeneralizing and making sure that this is, you know, this we're looking at this in one person's individual context. So I think that's super important. And I have also, I definitely haven't had clients that work out that early, but I have given out the recommendation of like, hey, if you really can't stomach food in the morning, then a big carb meal before bed is probably going to be a better bet for you to just make sure those glycogen stores are full, especially when, you know, maybe we're dieting or something like that. I did have one question for Grant that I kind of thought of on the fly and realized, this probably should have been one of the first questions we asked, but I don't think that it's necessarily technically defined. I think for a lot of people, this is common sense, but I think for other people, they might be looking for loopholes or looking for things to have, eat, or drink throughout the fasting period. So what exactly constitutes a fast? Is it not having anything except for water? Is it, can you have coffee? Can you have branched chains? You know, what have you done in the research, and what would you say that definition is?
That's a great question. And a lot of people get aggravated by this, because I sort of mentioned this a little bit when we were defining the subtypes of intermittent fasting, but there are a number of so-called intermittent fasting programs that have a fasting day that really allows calorie intake. So it's a modified fasting day, which is really just like a very low calorie intake day. So what I think is the right definition and the pure definition of fasting would be no calories are ingested. That certainly leaves some wiggle room. So certain things like branched chain amino acids would be considered as breaking the fast. Even if they're labeled as zero calorie, that's essentially like a labeling loophole for BCAAs. But they essentially provide the same calories per gram as protein. It's just, again, a loophole because they're individual amino acids instead of whole protein. So anything, you know, if I don't know if we still have this crowd around or not, but if you're talking about butter in your coffee, something like that certainly breaks the fast. Of course, this is a spectrum. Like if you literally ate one bite of food during a fasting period, how detectable would that be physiologically if we were monitoring your glucose, your ketone bodies, your fatty acids, all these things? Maybe not that detectable. So if you're having coffee and you're like, I don't like coffee black, I want just like a splash of milk, something like that, it's probably okay. The only way to be completely sure that nothing you're doing is breaking your fast would be to consume water only. However, many people would find that makes the fast more difficult. So things like black coffee, diet sodas, zero calorie flavored waters, lots of those items seem to help people during the fasting periods. My perspective is sort of middle of the road. So if it has calories, particularly appreciable amount of calories, I would consider it to some extent breaking your fast. However, if it's, again, that splash of creamer, splash of milk, and it's the difference between you being able to get through the fast that you do want to do versus not, then I'd say go ahead and do it. Worst case, if there are unique benefits of fasting in terms of the physiology, you may be missing out on a little bit of that, but you're not missing out on this very low calorie period that you're trying to implement. So yeah, again, I'd say anything with calories generally be considered breaking the fast. If you want to be a purist and want to be sure, water only. But practically, I would generally advise people that if diet soda helps you, if black coffee helps you, if flavored water helps you, then go for it.
I've seen some research talk about caffeine intake and whether that is considered breaking a fast. So even though you might have something like black coffee, if you're consuming a high amount of caffeine, then that can alter some things physiologically. Have you seen anything like that?
A little bit. Most of the things I'd see would be more favorable towards caffeine. So during the acute fasting periods, and this is one of the things kind of based on your previous question about the longer fast, that it depends a little bit on the duration of fast, but you do have a mild sympathetic response. So kind of fight or flight response to fasting that's evident at certain times and that can kind of increase your body's sensitivity to epinephrine or norepinephrine, some of these, you know, fight or flight stress hormones. So I haven't seen a lot of direct data on it, but the kind of piecing together data, you could see a theoretical benefit, I think, of having some caffeine during the fasting period, as long as it doesn't make you jittery or uncomfortable because you know, don't have any food in your stomach, because mm-hmm. some people are very sensitive. But I haven't seen anything that would be negative towards caffeine during the fasting periods at the group level. Again, if there's an anecdote where someone has bad experiences with it, that'd be one thing, but I wouldn't consider that as something that would break the fast.
Yeah, I think that also brings it back to the point that you were just saying, Grant, about how it really depends on what your goal is with the fast, because if you inherently believe that there is this magical benefit to fasting that goes beyond just restricting your calorie intake and making your appetite more manageable, then of course having 1 gram of milk in your coffee is going to make a difference. Or of course having branched chain amino acids is going to make a difference. But if your goal with shortening your feeding window is to make that reduction in calories easier, or to just not have to think about food so much, then does that really matter for you and what your goal and outcome that you're looking for with this strategy is? And so just kind of looking at that from a more objective perspective rather than attributing some magical properties to something without necessarily needing to.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think, yeah, based on the current evidence, the only thing we can, you know, view as a solid conclusion is the kind of energy balance calorie standpoint. It's within the realm of possibility. Some of the like very impressive benefits that have been seen in rodents someday will be documented better in humans. But yeah, for now, I think for most people, it's really just calorie management, how it fits with your lifestyle and so on. So yeah, I agree.
I think we wanted to ask another question, very important one about protein. So okay. When it comes to meal timing within that window, so of course, you know, outside of restricting your feeding window, we want to space our protein pretty evenly throughout the day. If you are listening to this and you didn't already know this, then that's definitely should be a goal of yours. And to not just eat, you know, your body weight in grams of protein in one sitting, because we do want to have those benefits, or at least assumed benefits, of having multiple spikes of muscle protein synthesis. As I describe it to clients, typically I'll describe it as, you know, recovery or stimulating muscle growth every time that you ingest a serving of protein. And so if your goal is to eat, you know, 100 grams of protein per day and you're eating 4 meals, then you should have roughly, you know, 25 grams at each of those meals. Now, when we shorten that window, it makes it a little bit tougher because maybe we're eating less times. Maybe instead of 4 or 5, we're eating 1 to 3 times, right? So how would your recommendations for spacing your protein change at all? Or would you say, you know, what is the best way to go about that?
Yeah, it wouldn't really change. It would just be, they're essentially getting pushed together. So I would be sure to essentially split the total amount of protein, your goal for the day. So say 100 grams, using the example you just gave, and split that in even doses, with 1 dose coming at the beginning of the period and 1 at the end of the period. And I would, as of now, I'd recommend at least 3 feedings. So with an 8-hour window, 3 should be achievable, probably even 4. So if you're doing 4, you could still do those 4 servings of 25 grams you mentioned. It'd just be like right at the beginning of the fast, say after 2.5 hours, after 5 hours, and then right at the end of the feeding period. So I probably said beginning of fast. I meant beginning of the feeding period. So yeah, I would evenly space those. Or if it's 3, you know, 33 gram serving right at the beginning of the feeding period, 33 gram in the middle, 33 gram at the end. So really same principles. You might just be pushing them together. If you are eating fewer times, then you would have a higher dose per meal. Again, I wouldn't go lower. I probably wouldn't go lower than 3. If you really want to mess around with 2, like if you're doing a short feeding window of 4 to 6 hours and you want to mess around with 2 feedings, you could. Even though it doesn't maybe directly translate, muscle protein synthesis data would probably say a minimum of 3. So yeah, no, I would say the same recommendation you normally give, just push together a little bit.
Yeah, and I think that makes a really good point for, like I was saying at the beginning, you know, we go from one extreme of, you know, clean eating is the way to go versus, you know, oh, now I can eat just pizza and Pop-Tarts and hit my macros with egg whites and protein shakes. And, you know, we find a solution in the middle. And so with the intermittent fasting conversation, we've kind of seen the same thing happen throughout the course of this podcast. You know, we've gone from, okay, well, the belief was originally to eat as many times per day, as long as they're nice and like spaced apart, you know, 6 meals a day, 10 meals a day, whatever it might be. And then we went down the other rabbit hole of saying, okay, well, what happens if we eat in a 4-hour window or a 6-hour window? You know, what is feasible there? And then, you know, we kind of settle in this middle ground, but then, you know, the conversation was then taken to, okay, well, now we have intermittent fasting, meal timing doesn't matter at all. And so people took it from, I think, just kind of the masses and the media took it from, okay, you know, before we said you had to eat 5 or 6 times a day, and now you can just, you know, eat within this window however you want, and, you know, nothing else matters and you'll see results. But then we go through this discussion and we say, well, you know, try to space your food out and your protein out evenly throughout your feeding window, even if you're using time-restricted feeding. And so, you know, again, we're starting on the extremes and we're kind of whittling our way into the middle with this conversation as it gets more nuanced and as we, you know, learn more about how all of this stuff works with our physiology.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. And in regards to, yeah, you're absolutely right. It's intermittent fasting is definitely, people treat it this way, but it's not a blanket, you know, what you eat doesn't matter. And would we expect, say, someone eats from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. and then they ate all those exact same foods, same quantities, everything from noon to 8, like shaving off 2 hours on each end? Do we expect that that would have like a major meaningful difference in their health, body composition, et cetera? Probably not, not really. Another kind of practical aspect that, you know, may be relevant to some listeners is, this may be a little less relevant if you track really carefully. And if you're like, I'm going to do the same tracked meals either in 8 hours or 12 hours or whatever, it'll be the same food I eat. But for people who don't track, and that might be some of the people who are drawn towards intermittent fasting, kind of considering at the individual level how this affects your behavior and food choices, I think is really important. Some people can adjust to a shorter window and they're like, yeah, I cut out the junk or not junk. I cut out the food I would eat after 8 p.m. and it wasn't much of a difference. Other people might be like, oh, it's 7:30 p.m. I need to like get all the foods I would have wanted to eat late at night in now, and I'm going to eat all this stuff. We've seen that even in our studies. We've done some studies of acute 24-hour fasts, then monitoring what people eat after that. Some people after a 24-hour fast would not really compensate at all. They'd eat like 10% of their weight maintenance calorie needs when, you know, at 7 p.m. they're now allowed to eat after 24 hours of not eating. There'd be some other people who in one evening would eat over 100% of their weight maintenance needs. So they would go and they would essentially binge. So I think recognizing that about yourself, or even, you know, if it, for someone who's a coach, kind of talking to a client and trying to understand some of those behaviors or the way they think about things, that may help kind of give a clue to who this may or may not be beneficial for.
I think that's a really good point that you bring up with when it comes to, and Marissa and I have talked about this all the time, when it comes to a diet or when it comes to a tool that you can utilize, whether your goal is, you know, weight loss or weight gain, lean, you know, lean muscle gain, that you have to figure out what's going to be right for you and what's going to fit your schedule. And it's not like, oh, well, intermittent fasting is this magical thing that's going to help me reach my goals. Is if you can't adhere to it, or if the next day you're eating 100% over what your maintenance calories are, well, then, it, you know, maybe we need to try something different. So I think it's really important for listeners out there who, whatever their goals are, to maybe be open to try new things. And if something doesn't work for you, that doesn't make you a failure. That just means that particular diet or that particular tool doesn't work for you, and that's okay. And just be open to trying something different and then finding something that does work for you and your schedule. And also keeping in mind that, and again, Marissa and I talk about this all the time, that something that works for you now may not work for you 6 months down the road. Maybe you have a new job, or maybe you have a brand new kid, and that, you know, intermittent fasting or whatever it is that you're trying to utilize doesn't work. So just being flexible with whatever you're trying to do to reach your goals.
Yeah, I love that. And just kind of bringing in our coaching perspectives into this conversation a little bit more. I definitely wanted to add one more thing to that before asking Grant one more question. Just things to remember if you are going to apply time-restricted eating to your day, to your life. that still matter. So the first thing that I'm going to say is calories in versus calories out still matters. So, you know, like Grant said, you might be able to get away with not tracking your food if you are going to shorten your feeding window, depending on the type of person that you are and how it affects your behavior. But the principle of your calories being reduced by this method is still how that mechanism is actually working for the most part, and from what we know with the research so far. So if you are going to implement time-restrictive eating, please know that it's most likely, you know, if you're seeing results from it, it's probably because your calories reduced. The next thing that really still matters is your protein intake. So like he said in his studies, when protein was controlled for, I think you were very deliberate about saying that, that the gains in lean mass and the changes in muscle tissue, correct me if I'm wrong, were the ones that improved over time and were similar. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so protein still matters. And they are definitely keeping track of that in Grant's lab, which is very important because we know that that is one of the biggest determinants of body composition change when it comes to lean muscle tissue. And then as we talked about, what works for you? So adherence. If you're going to apply it, know that your adherence to it still works. So or still matters in terms of, you know, whether this approach is going to work for you. So we've talked about this a lot and we've kind of beaten this into the ground, but make sure it's actually an approach that you can adhere to and enjoy and doesn't make you hate the way that you're eating or hate your life. and then finally, you know, keep training as a part of the context as well. So if you are going to apply time-restricted eating, make sure that it's something that works with your training schedule, or if you can change your training schedule, if you really want to implement this feeding window, but maybe you were that person who trains first thing in the morning and you wanted to do the 12 to 8, you know, you might have to switch some things around if you're really adamant about implementing this into your life. So making sure that that is still something that fits your schedule as well. So yeah, the final question that I have for Grant, we're so grateful to have you on and for all of this amazing insight, but we were just curious, and of course only disclose what you can, because I know some of this stuff kind of has to stay under wraps until it's published, but future research that you would like to see done or are planning on doing in the future, you know, as general or specific as you can be.
Yeah, so I'll give a few items. I don't think there's anything too confidential I can't talk about. I will mention one sort of interesting thing. The one of the studies that of time-restricted eating and resistance training, the one that's conducted over in Italy in my friend and collaborator's lab, Antonio Paoli, that was the one that had very, very trained male participants. So that was a kind of traditional 8-week study, but we actually were able to continue it out to a full year of time-restricted eating with resistance training, which is really unusually long for a study like this. Usually it's just not feasible. So we have those data under review currently, which I think will be very interesting because often most of these studies are a couple months long and the limitation that's stated is always longer term data are needed. And we put that out there, but practically it's very difficult to run a study like this for a year. But we do have some of that year long data that will be coming out. So I won't say too much more about that now, but I'll definitely post about it on social media when it's published. So that's just something that's kind of exciting. In terms of other future directions, one would be kind of continuing to answer that question you asked of how short of a window is too short. And this will really involve continuing to push it on how short the window is until we see a problem, and a problem in terms of exercise performance adaptations or body composition improvement. So I do have an interest in that. That would probably involve something like a 6-hour group, 4-hour group, something like that, where we're pushing it down lower. I also have an interest in other forms of intermittent fasting. So we've largely looked at time-restricted eating with resistance training. There are a few studies with resistance training and other forms of intermittent fasting, but they're largely not relevant to like sort of the populations of interest for us. So either due to the resistance training program or the actual participants, just not quite as generalizable. So we would like to look into some other forms as well, whether that's periodic fasting. It'd probably be some form of periodic fasting rather than alternate day fasting. Could even be something potentially like you mentioned, Christy, about the longer but less frequent fasts. If it was like a once a week fast that was a little bit longer, like 36 hours or something like that, and seeing how that really affected the overall energy intake over the course of a week, and if that was compensated for, if that limited adaptations to exercise and so on. Then I also have a little bit of an interest, which we got into just a tiny bit, but have an interest in sort of characterizing what acute changes occur over the course of a single fast. And the idea here would be to see if there's some sort of optimal duration of fast. So based on existing data, for example, there's some really pretty profound metabolic changes that occur from 14, 16 hours of fasting up until say 20 to 24 hours of fasting in terms of lipolysis and fat oxidation. So a number of these popular programs that utilize say 16 hour fasting periods are based on available data stopping kind of just short of a what would possibly be a more beneficial time physiologically. So kind of characterizing this, is it better to do a 16 hour fast every day or would it be better to do one 24 hour fast a week or two 24 hour fasts a week or something like that? And sort of related to that and related to the question about what breaks a fast, sort of hunger and appetite management techniques during fasting, I think is interesting as well. And kind of continuing to tease out like what types of people might succeed with intermittent fasting, what types of people might not exceed. Is there a way through like a test period of fasting or a questionnaire we could get the information we need to advise someone concerning whether or not intermittent fasting would be an appropriate program for them? So those are just kind of a few interests that hopefully we'll be able to pursue some of them, and hopefully some other labs will as well.
Yeah, and I can imagine how hard it is trying to, when your main focus is how participants are eating, just being able to monitor more closely or have like, you know, not having them in cages and feeding them, but finding something where you know that they are being more adherent or they're doing what they're actually saying that they're doing.
Yes, no, I agree. And you know, we usually, the last study we provided food scales and taught participants about weighing and all of that, but it's so hard because we'd have some participants who I think were actually accurately weighing, but even though we told them to eat normally, we'd hear things like, oh, I didn't eat dessert yesterday because I didn't want to write it down on my sheet, or I didn't want to weigh it out and know how much I was eating. And it's hard because there's that aspect of, you know, people feeling like their foods they should and shouldn't eat and all that. So all that to say, I agree completely. It's definitely a challenge.
I think that is so relevant too, because we see that on a day-to-day basis with our clients. And so I think the first thing that, and I think I'm speaking for you too, Christina, that we have our clients do when they start with us is they do some data collection on themselves. So I say, hey, don't change anything about what you're eating. Just, you know, log everything so that I can get a nice little baseline of like where you're actually at. But then, you know, I see the numbers and I'm like, this person definitely doesn't eat like this 24/7. Otherwise they'd be shriveled up into nothing. So it does give us a baseline, but they're probably not also accounting for the drinks on the weekends or the date night out or the snacks right before bed. So we do also keep that in mind. And I think even when people are honestly plugging in everything, everyone kind of has, I mean, there are universal ways to track your food, but everyone kind of takes things, information in differently, and they learn how to apply that differently. And so, you know, the question, should I weigh my food raw versus cooked, or do my vegetables, you know, lose weight or gain weight when I bake them or saute them or whatever? What about the oil that I put in the pan? All of these things are little variables when we're studying behavior that are so difficult to control for that, you know, of course, collecting some data is better than nothing, but we also have to look at, okay, well, what else is going into this that maybe we can't really account for or have as much certainty in our findings because of?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So Grant, I'm curious, we talked a whole bunch about time-restricted eating, intermittent fasting, and meal timing, and long fast, short fast. And I want to know, and I'm very curious, what do you personally implement in your day today?
Oh, I don't always get asked that one. So I'll say that probably for the majority of the last, how many years has it been? 8 years or so since I first got interested in this topic. I'd say the majority of the time I've probably implemented some form of time-restricted eating. What I currently do is a little bit what I recommended for the challenging situation where someone trains in the morning. So essentially on weekends, I'll train midday or in the morning. And on those days, I eat a carbohydrate and protein rich meal several hours before working out. So essentially don't really do time-restricted eating. I guess technically it's probably within a 12-hour period of time, but not very restricted. On weekdays when I'd work out in the late afternoon or evening, I'll often do you know, eat my first meal between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m., depending on the day. And then I'll kind of cycle through. There'll be some periods where I implement it a little more strictly, which would be more or less not eating after dinner, and other periods where I won't impose that restriction. Some of that pertains to if I'm trying to hit a certain performance goal in the gym or a certain body comp goal. So I'd say in general, I implement some form of time-restricted eating, but relatively flexibly, and, you know, more strictly in periods where I'm, say, in a fat loss phase, and quite a bit less strictly in periods when I'm in a gaining phase. So yeah, I guess flexible time-restricted eating approach would be the overall theme.
Awesome. Very cool.
Yeah. Thanks for asking.
Do you find that people expect you to adhere to a more strict approach? Yeah. Or like, cause you're the time restricted eating guy. So, you know, if you're not eating at a 4-hour window every day, then what are you doing?
I guess. Yeah. So I'm laughing cause I don't, so this is an anecdote I just shared one other time on a podcast, but I was at a conference a few years ago, and it was like the middle of the afternoon. It was just like a normal time to be eating, or lunchtime or something. And I was eating and someone passed by. Honestly, I don't truly remember who it was. I think it was someone who's like sort of an acquaintance, and they saw me eating and they like did a double take and looked at me and they said, wait, why are you eating? I thought you're like a fasting guy. And like, one, what does that even mean to be a fasting guy? I'm like, I researched this. That doesn't mean I don't eat. I'm like, even people who do intermittent fasting eat. So lots of people will say like, oh, I could never do intermittent fasting. I love to eat too much. And I'm like, I do too. I enjoy eating like several larger meals and then smaller snacks that are essentially protein throughout the day rather than spreading out. So for me personally, it works. But yeah, I do sometimes feel that there's that expectation. Or if I gave the answer I gave, they're like, wait, you only like kind of adhere to this, or you sometimes do it. I'm like, yeah, I'm interested in studying this academically. It was a gap in the literature. It's something lots of people are interested in. But I have no vested interest in fasting, and I'm not, you know, the advocate for everyone to be fasting or anything like that.
Well, I think that's great though, because if you're the one doing the research and you have this strong bias for fasting, then you might take your results and say, oh, well, you know, the markers here and this group. And so I think it's good when you're the fasting guy, but it's because of your interest in the research, not necessarily because you're trying to push for one form of dieting.
Thank you. That's the goal. And I appreciate that.
Yeah. And being impartial with that kind of stuff is so hard, because I think the main reason that most people get into an area of research is because of a vested interest, or at least I know that is why I got into the area that I'm starting to dip my toes into now, and how a lot of people, you know, get into research in general is because mm-hmm. of their passion. And so it's really hard to be impartial, especially with something as close to our hearts as like nutrition and meal timing and resistance training that we love and makes up such an important part of our day, to not be mm-hmm. biased and to not just cherry pick out of the data what we want to see.
Yeah. And it's, you know, of course, from the researcher perspective, of course, it'd be more exciting to find that it's like, oh, fasting is way better than everything else. We're going to report this. Everyone will be super interested in this. And we have reported some benefits, and we've reported lack of benefits. So yeah, our goal is to just conduct the research the right way, present the information, try to interpret it, but ultimately just put it all out there for people to be able to evaluate and also draw their own conclusions.
Yeah, that's great.
Thank you.
Yeah, I love that. Christina, do you have any other questions or anything you want to add?
I think that's it. I think when we were talking a little bit about fed training and fasted training, I know that there is always that big question when it comes to fasted cardio. I know that is huge, and we have what we would recommend to our clients, but I don't know if you've done any research or if you've looked into that, because I know that we have a lot of clients who, again, they sometimes have that old school mentality when it comes to certain things with training and cardio.
Yeah, I'd have a fairly similar view on fasted cardio as I do to intermittent fasting, that it's fine. It's a viable option. If it's something where, say, someone's performance isn't affected either way, like it's just moderate intensity, they could do it either way. If they prefer to do it fasted, similar to what you're talking about, say they wake up first thing in the morning, I don't think they should feel like a slave to the idea of, oh, I have to eat my breakfast and then wait an hour before I go do my cardio. But at the same time, I don't think they should expect a greater benefit for doing the cardio fasted. So I would view it fairly pragmatically there. And similar to some of the other principles we talked about with intermittent fasting would be, how does this affect me the rest of my day? Do I compensate for the fact that I did fasted exercise? Do I feel way hungrier and eat a much larger breakfast after that? Or do I just kind of continue about my day and it's, you know, no difference? I'm guessing this might not be relevant to too many of the people you coach, but there are some people who intentionally implement fasted training as part of a intentional train low strategy, so training with low carbohydrate availability to promote some cellular adaptations related to endurance performance. So it wouldn't improve performance that session, like in a heavy endurance session, it would probably impair performance, but it might improve something cellularly that would then help them subsequently perform. But that's really kind of a niche for high level endurance athletes. That would be my two cents. I don't know if that's similar to what you all recommend or if you have a different view.
Yeah, I think that we recommend similar, just whatever fits your schedule. So if you have to complete your cardio at 4 a.m, because that's the only thing that works, then it's probably not likely that you're going to want to start your eating window at that time. So doing your cardio in a fasted state, but also realizing that that is not going to make or break your results or increase any extra weight loss. So it's just a matter of timing and scheduling and what works for you. Because there are on the flip side, there are some people that think that, well, if you're not properly fueled for your session, your output actually might be lower. So I think it's just figuring out, you know, are you able to complete the same amount of cardio with the same amount of intensity? And if not, then maybe pushing it to later in the evening when you are fed and you do have that energy. So just trying to figure out what works for you, your body, and your schedule.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. And that's a key factor on, can you do the same exercise? And that's one where, like on the resistance training side, you probably often see if someone's going in for like a heavy lower body session, probably most people will perform better in the fed state. But yeah, the say moderate cardio session, some people can just, you know, do it fine either way.
Yeah. Well, no, I think this was a great episode. We answered a lot of questions. We got a lot of really good information, and I'm really, really excited for our listeners to hear this.
Yeah, thank you so much for just letting us pick your brain and giving us a bunch of insight, because, you know, like we said, we're not experts on time-restricted feeding specifically, but it's really great to just bring on experts in different areas and educate our audience, because I think a lot of the stuff that Christina and I listen to, it's a lot of the really, really invested individuals in health and fitness, and a lot of them are likely coaches or in research themselves. But the people that are listening to this podcast are our clients, and are a lot of people who are just trying to figure out what's going to work for them. And I think this was the perfect introduction to this topic and gave enough detail, but in a way that they can really break it down and apply it to their own lives. So thank you so much for being on.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure. Great speaking with you both. And congratulations again on the successful launch of the podcast. And I'm sure there are great days ahead for it.
Thank you. Well, great. If any of our listeners are interested in finding out more about you, where can they find you on social media?
Yeah. So on Instagram, my handle is Grant_Tinsley, T-I-N-S-L-E-Y. I'm probably most active on Twitter also, Grant Tinsley, PhD with no spaces. And then if someone really wants information on our lab, and do, I have a personal site, which is just grant.com.
Awesome. So we'll make sure we have all of that in the show notes. So if any of you guys are interested, you can find it there. But we hope you guys really enjoyed this episode. It was a pleasure having Grant on today. And if you haven't already, make sure you're subscribed to the podcast. You can find both of us on Instagram. You can find me at Christy Lynn Fit, and Marissa is at Marissa Roy Fitness. So thank you guys so much for listening to this episode, and we will see you next week.
Thank you so much for listening to the Barbell Lifestyle Podcast, and we hope you enjoyed this episode and learned something from it. Please remember that Christina and I are not medical professionals, so if you're going to make any changes to your exercise or nutrition routines, please consult with your doctor or medical team first. Finally, we would love you even more than we already do if you took the time to leave us a rating and review on iTunes. Ratings and reviews are how this podcast moves up the ranks and becomes accessible to even more people. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next Tuesday here at the Barbell Lifestyle Podcast.